Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper New York Times best-selling author Tasha Alexander, who is not only a good friend of Joy on Paper, she was a host during the pandemic along with her globally best-selling author husband, Andrew Grant. Hi, Tasha.
Hey, Patsy. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. It's so wonderful to have you back. And again, I'm always so grateful that during the pandemic, you two stepped up and helped me out when I couldn't even get out of the house.
Oh, well, you know, we'll do anything for you. Now, were you affected by the hurricane at all?
Not at all. You know, we were prepped for it. It was supposed to land right here on top of us. Everything showed that it was going to hit us. Then it shifted. You know, it's so sad what's happened, you know, south of us, particularly Fort Myers, because Fort Myers has always been a magnet for authors because they have an enormous reading community. And so many authors have always put Fort Myers on their tour. So when they come to Florida, they would go to Miami and Fort Myers because those two areas had such lovely venues.
Well, you know, the last event I did before COVID was at the Sanibel Library. So,
oh wow!
You know, thinking of all of them, yeah, such a special place, and that's a great reading community too. I mean, I was just blown away by their library and their community.
And the big writing community, too. Many authors live down there.
Oh, yeah.
Well, because we have many writers who live in this area, many famous authors, because it's conducive to writing. I think either, you know, you want to go up to the mountains where you are, or like Jerome Priestley was telling me, up in Maine where he gets, you know, snowed in for 6 months.
Exactly.
And, of course, you... Whoa! I don't know how long it took you, a year, to write this new book, which is absolutely fantastic. And it's, you know,
oh, thank you.
Secrets of the Nile. I was waiting for it. You know, I always tell all of my listeners that if you want to take a grand tour, particularly during the pandemic, you want to take a grand tour of Europe, you have to read Tasha Alexander because you can go city to city. And, of course, now we're down there in Egypt, sailing up the Nile. So it must have been an exciting time, not just for, you know, the writing of it, but the research.
It was, although, you know, I didn't get to go to Egypt because of COVID. But, you know, that's how it goes, right?
I know. It's terrible. You know, you plan on something and you think, you know, that I can jump on a plane. And so many authors, the same thing happened.
Yeah, but, you know, we had actually booked a trip and thought... we might be able to go. You know, we'd postponed it a few times, but it was right when Omicron was coming, and honestly, we felt like it wasn't ethically right to go to a place where vaccines were not widely available when we can get vaccinated. You know, it just didn't seem, because you can still spread it even if you don't get sick, you know. So we just felt like it was not
It was too dangerous a time to fly, that's for sure.
I think it was.
You know, everybody put off their trips. But so many of my listeners did enjoy. I would be recommending your books as you want to go on a trip through Europe, just read Tasha, head to her website, and you can see so much about her books, and then just pick a city, and off you go.
And isn't that one of the nicest things about reading? I mean, I think from the time I was a little girl, that was one of the main things that attracted me to it. You know, I felt like I could go anywhere in the world in a book.
And you certainly have. And, of course, you and I, you know, we spent so much of our time in the reading room at the British Museum. And, you know, we've done so much research into all of this sort of the era of the Victorian era, which I love and you love. And so it was just a natural for you to head with Lady Emily to the Nile.
Well, yeah, it was, you know, I mean, the Victorians and the Edwardians loved to travel, and Egypt was a top destination for them, you know, which I think is so wonderful and charming, especially when you think of how most people think about the Victorians being very staid and conservative and, you know, wouldn't do anything. Well, actually, that's not true. They were doing all kinds of stuff. So, you know, a lot of people today are leery of going to Egypt, right? It's so far, they don't speak the language, but, you know, the Victorians were happy to just jump right in and do it.
Oh, they did. They were amazing travelers, and the wonderful thing about it was that they wrote books about it so that we have all of that wonderful material. Isn't it so much fun
Yes.
that you can find really details of their travels and discussions of the costs of things, of what they were wearing. It makes it so, it makes it really so much fun to do the research into that time.
It absolutely is. There's just such a wealth of primary source information. You know, I was inspired so much when I was writing Secrets of the Nile by a variety of memoirs that I read, you know, including one where you had a duke who only went to Egypt for the weather. Didn't care at all about going to any of the tombs, temples, anything, you know, just here for the weather. You know, the people who would insist on being carried everywhere in a sedan chair.
Well, anyone who spent a winter in England can appreciate going to Egypt for the weather.
For the weather, right? But you would think while you were there, you might want to see some of the stuff, right?
Well, you know,
If you're a duke, you might not.
Yeah, why not? Why do it? You know, it's so much fun when you are reading these original source materials and you can see and read about how excited they were to make these trips.
Oh, yeah. No, it's wonderful. And, of course, you know, you had in the Victorian era Thomas Cook, the travel company, which really was, you know, those guys were the ones who really made Egypt relatively accessible for people, for Western travelers, you know, with their cruises up the Nile and, you know, this idea that you could just go to the Thomas Cook office in London and say, I want to go see Egypt, and everything would be taken care of, which made it a lot easier.
And they had so many stores that were just set up to, you know, get the travelers all equipped for everything they needed, from their underwear
exactly.
to everything.
Oh, yeah. Their smoke-colored sunglasses.
Exactly. So tell us now, in the news story of Lady Emily, of course, this is always fun, but particularly in this one, you're sort of paying an homage to somebody very famous tell us how you came out with this idea.
Well, you know, I had always from the very beginning wanted to have a book set in Egypt. And so, you know, this was when I decided the time was right to do that. And when I was first sitting down in that really early phase of working on a book where you're just fishing around for ideas and, you know, just reading lots of things, doing lots of research. And as part of that, I thought, well, I mean, I've got to reread Death on the Nile, right? Because we've all read Death on the Nile. It's wonderful. And I thought that's a great place to start. And, you know, I had not gone back and reread Agatha Christie in so long. I don't know why. I mean, I guess because, you know, there are so many books that we all want to read, right? So it's hard to make time to go back and read things that you've already read once, right? When you have this ever-growing stack of things that you haven't yet read. But so I read Death on the Nile again, and, you know, it's just marvelous. And I thought, you know, I am just going to let myself read all of the Poirot books again. And it was just such fun. And it was actually while I was reading one of, you know, so I was doing this sort of in the background while I was doing research on Egypt. And I won't say which book it is because it would kind of give things away too much, but I was reading one of the books and partway through I thought I was like, ooh, is this what happens? And it wasn't what happened. what I wanted it to be what happened, and so that's what I made happen in this book, if that makes any sense, yeah. without giving anything away. Yeah. But, you know, Poirot is such a great character. He's just so much fun. And so I just, you know, I so enjoyed rereading all of those books, and I thought, okay, whatever I do with this story, it's going to be an homage to Poirot and Agatha Christie.
And it certainly is. Now tell us, and of course, we also have here, we have, of course, Lady Emily. And tell us about her husband, which you know, is always so wonderful. It was, when you introduced him, I was so thrilled. But this time we have his mother along. So tell us a little bit about
yes.
Colin.
Well, so Colin is, you know, he's an agent of the crown, which means that he, you know, this is before you had a formalized intelligence service in Britain. But you had gentlemen of means who did work for the empire. And so Colin is frequently called upon to take care of issues that are important to the empire that require a modicum of discretion, generally speaking. And so a lot of times when they're traveling about, it's because Colin is working, right? But this time, they're actually just on holiday. And they are on holiday because Colin's very formidable mother, who we haven't seen, I think we haven't seen Anne Hargreaves since Dangerous to Know.
Yeah.
When they were, Emily and Colin were staying at her house in Normandy. But, you know, it was very fun because it was actually my agent said to me, you know, I'd really love to see Colin's mother again. And I thought, yeah, we haven't seen her for a long time. Let's bring her into this book. And then so I promptly pulled out all my notes about the character and all of that. And I had actually, you know, it's embarrassing to say, but you forget things that you write because, you know, I wrote Dangerous to Know, gosh, probably in 2009. That's a long time ago. And I forgot that part of Anne Hargreaves' backstory is that she got engaged to her husband halfway up the Great Pyramid in Cairo when she was spending a decade traveling about the world because she had no interest in getting married. And I thought, well, this is just meant to be because Egypt has such a place in her history. So in the story, we have one of her good friends going back to childhood inviting her to come visit his house in Luxor, where he winters every year, and she invites Emily and Colin's daughter Kat to come with her.
Well, I love mothers or mothers-in-law in a book. Ever since I read Lord Peter Wimsey, you just fall in love with the Dowager Duchess of Denver, who is so wonderful in these books, you know, that when you read the books and you remember the Duchess, she stands out, you know? And so it was fun that you introduced here Colin's mother.
Yeah, she was fun to write, and I was happy to have her back. I'm glad you liked her.
Yeah, you know, this is, it adds the depth, and I like the... you know, you always sort of like somebody who's sharp tongue or witty, so she gives a lot to the story.
I'm glad. It's always fun to, you know, I think it's one thing with this series that I think is really fun is that you have the opportunity to bring in, you know, characters that reveal pieces about your primary character's lives. And obviously parents tell us a lot about their children, don't they?
Exactly. I mean, I always wondered where Dorothy Sayers got the idea for the Duchess of Denver, because she seems so real, you know?
Exactly.
So now we have quite a nice cast of characters, which we need in a mystery, because we don't know who's going to do it. Somebody's going
right.
to die.
That's
I mean,
right.
we know somebody's going to die. You know, we never want to give too much away, but somebody dies. And so tell us about the beginning of the story.
Yeah, so unfortunately, or fortunately, based on your perspective, I suppose, the person who dies is Lord Dealey, Anne Hargrave's dear friend who has invited them to Egypt. And he's a kind of eccentric guy. Well, actually, I don't know. I know that technically we're in the Edwardian era, but he's clearly a Victorian. And for the Victorians, I would say he's not particularly eccentric. You know, he's a guy who's rich, who winters in Luxor. A lot of them did that. That wasn't highly unusual. But the unusual piece about him is that, well, his house is based on traditional ancient Egyptian architecture, and he has decorated it with artifacts because he is a collector. And again, now being a collector of antiquities in the Victorian era, not eccentric, right?
No, lots, I mean, they all did it. They were like passionate about collecting things.
They absolutely were. So he has gathered this group of friends together, you know, his nearest and dearest, and Emily and Colin and Colin's mom have come separately because Anne Hargreaves didn't want to join the others on Lord Dealey's boat because it's a steamboat, and she has very fond memories of cruising up the Nile with her late husband on a dahabiyah, which is a much more romantic way to see Egypt and to cruise the Nile, and it's quieter than a steamship. One thing that just struck me again and again and again when I was reading memoirs was, you really get that, like the steamboat people versus the dahabiyah people, because, you know, dahabiyah, you've got primarily a sailboat. If there's no wind, then the crew can row if they must. But the steamboat has an engine, and it's loud, and it makes everything shake in the boat. And so, obviously, you know, Anne Hargreaves was not going to be involved with that. So they have cruised up the Nile separately, and because they're in the dahabiyah, it takes them longer to get there, get to Luxor, that is. And so the day they arrive in Luxor, Lord Dealey greets them at the dock, and when they come to the kind of, he's having a big dinner party at his house that evening to welcome them and, you know, get them introduced to everyone else who's made up the party to stay and tour Egypt together. Unfortunately, he dies at the conclusion of that meal.
And you know,
in his dining room that is painted like a tomb.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, being a collector and having many wonderful artifacts, and many, of course, which then connect to the other story within the book. I love these parallel stories because you do, I mean, one of the reasons I think that people love to collect things in general is you hold something and you feel like you just might have a connection.
Exactly.
So
you feel a tangible connection,
exactly,
don't you?
You do. And I mean, I have done that. You know, I lived in Iran for a long time, and there were times where I would find something, and I would, like, it would be almost magical. You'd feel like you're connected to something thousands of years before, and that's what happens, you know. And so with him having some of these wonderful, wonderful artifacts, it gives you this opportunity to talk about sculpture in general, which is, you know, the Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians. When you think of the work they did, it is so amazing.
Oh, it really is. And, you know, I love having the dual timelines. That's what I love to read, and I think you should write what you love to read. But I just love getting to explore a second time period. And ancient Egypt is so, so fascinating. I actually, years and years ago, in another lifetime, I actually studied Middle Egyptian at Yale. And so it was really, I wanted with this book to be able to go back and pull out all my hieroglyph stuff and, you know, get back into that. And the Merit, who is the protagonist in the ancient part of the story, I was thinking a lot about what I wanted her to be, who I wanted her to be. And as I was doing the research, you, of course, have right outside the Valley of the Kings, or right next to, sort of in the Valley of Kings, is this the ruins of this village, which the Egyptians called Pademi, and which we call Deir al-Medina. And it was a purpose-built village that the pharaoh ordered constructed to house the workers and the artisans who built the royal tombs. So it is actually the primary source that we have for information about daily life in ancient Egypt, because since it was out in the it's out in the desert, so it's not like Luxor being built on ancient Thebes, right, where you've lost so much of ancient Thebes. Nothing else is ever built there. So, you know, there's just this treasure trove of primary source information and letters, diaries, all kinds of just phenomenal sources that come out of Deir el-Medina. But also, what a neat place, right? Think about this. This is a little town, and everyone who lives there is an artisan of some sort. You're a painter, a sculptor, a stonemason, you know, all of these. So what an interesting community that must have been. So I was really taken with that, and I wanted to set the ancient part of the story in that town, and have merit. Because, look, if you've got everyone is an artisan, you're growing up in this amazing kind of environment, right, with all these artistic people, it's going to pull out whatever artistic talent you have. And she is a sculptor, but she sculpts in a way that's different from the kind of traditional Egyptian sculpture, which is we all know what those gorgeous Egyptian sculptures look like, right? They're not meant to be portraits. They're formulaic is not the right word, because that has a negative connotation. But the idea wasn't that it wasn't like Roman busts, right, where you're really making it look like the person. It was more symbolic. And I wanted Merit isn't going to have, she's a woman, right? So she's not going to be employed by the pharaoh to work in the tombs, which means that she actually has the freedom to kind of do her art however she wants.
I think that's what makes it so much fun. Because, I don't know, did you ever sculpt? Have you ever done any sculpting?
No.
I have, and I know how much fun it is. I could not imagine being a girl in a community like that and not picking up the tool. I mean, I would have done it. I was sculpting from a very young age, because I was also sort of around rocks and wood, all of my childhood. And I just, yeah. I love the feel. I love the tactile nature of sculpting something and making it. And I love this character, and I love this side story. As you said, it's this dual timeline, and it so works into the, you know, the 1904 timeline to make it really something that you, it's almost magical, because you have this connection.
Well, and you know, as I was writing it, I had no idea how the two stories were going to connect. But I have faith in the subconscious, and I thought it will become clear to me. And it did.
It did. It certainly did. And I, as I said, I love it. I think it's so wonderful. And I think also, you know, I hope that some women who are reading it will sort of be inspired. I never was told I couldn't do anything. You know, I was told I could do anything. And I know you all were also raised by parents who believed that you could do anything.
Absolutely.
And I hope that it sort of opens some of the reader's mind and says, yeah, you know, if somebody could sculpt, you know, 2,000 years ago, I can do something, you know, I can do something creative.
Exactly.
I think it's fun. Tell us just a little bit more about this study in Yale. Why did you pick this subject to study?
I've just always been interested in ancient Egypt. My parents took me to see the Tutankhamun exhibit, you know, the big one with the original one. Well, I guess not the original one, because I guess there had been an earlier one, at the Field Museum in Chicago when I was a little girl, and I was just utterly captivated by it. And there's just something about the lines of Egyptian art that really draw me in. And of course, if you like looking at Egyptian art, so much of it has hieroglyphs on it, right? So I wanted to learn how to read them. So I was living in New Haven, Connecticut. My now ex-husband was doing his postdoctoral work at Yale, and I just went and said, I want to study Middle Egyptian. And they were like, great, come study Middle Egyptian with us. So I did. And it was really, it's really a tough, tough language to get a handle on. You know, it strikes me, because, I mean, I've studied Russian. I once tried for about 3 days to study Turkish. That did not go well. You really take for granted the alphabet. And when you start studying, like, Russian, you know, we have to learn a new alphabet. You really understand how much you take the alphabet for granted. Because, you know, of course, French, Italian, Spanish, whatever, at least you know the alphabet, right?
Exactly.
And with Middle Egyptian, you know, you're not just... You have to learn the Middle Egyptian alphabet. You have, because you can't even, I mean, think about using a dictionary, right?
Yeah, exactly. So,
well, which letter is the quail chick? How do I look up the quail? You know, you have to know this whole, and in fact, I have this wonderful Middle Egyptian dictionary. It's all hand-drawn. I mean, it would have to be, right? You know, I mean, now I suppose there are fonts, but no, it was a wonderful experience, and it's such an interesting language because, well, for so many reasons, but one of the things that really struck me about it was that, you know, English, you read left to right. There are languages that you read right to left. Egyptian, Middle Egyptian, can be read either direction because, I mean, think about how beautiful the hieroglyphs are, right? And how you've got so much of them carved in the tombs and on temples. They wanted it to be aesthetically pleasing. So it may be written so that you're reading it left to right, right to left, if you're reading it vertically instead of horizontally, so that it looks right in the space. And the way you know which direction to read is the direction, you read to the faces. So, you know, there are lots of little hieroglyphs that are people. So you're reading to the faces, and that's how you know which direction. But I just thought, how great that they cared so much about the aesthetic, right? That they actually made their written language in a way that it could be presented in the most beautiful way.
I think it's wonderful that you incorporated your knowledge of hieroglyphs and all of the research that you've done into this book, because one of the things, I don't want to give it away, but I'm going to say, just because there's something at the end of the book, certain characters are missing, and then
right.
They appear near the very end. And I so wanted, because of course it reminds me of Elizabeth Peters and her wonderful.
Oh yes.
And I'm sort of hoping, I don't know what your plans are, but I was sort of hoping that Lady Emily would stay in Egypt for a while longer so that certain people could have some fun.
Yeah, so they could see those tombs, right?
Yeah, I have a feeling that this would be a perfect thing to happen to them because, I want them to get lost in a tomb.
I know.
So,
well, you know, I would love to because, of course, the next book isn't still in Egypt.
I know.
But I would love to write a little short story about
that's right. Maybe you can have
being lost in tomb.
I think you have to do some shove in a novella there because I wanted somebody to have lots of fun.
You may be happy to know, and you're the first to know. So the next book, which is set in Scotland, those characters feature prominently.
Oh, good. Because they are wonderful. You know, so I just want to say, you know, of course, I know it's your pub day and you're busy, but I wanted to, of course, always have you on first because it's so important. And I also wanted to mention, I know because of the way that you and I both have spent a lot of time in England and love England, and of course you actually have, you live with an Englishman, for goodness sakes.
I had to get my own Mr. Darcy somehow.
That's right, and you did. You certainly grabbed him. The recent loss of Queen Victoria, you know, I was going to say Queen Victoria because I could live through that funeral too. I know it so well as you do. But this recent loss of Queen Elizabeth was really so devastating, and I was just hooked on watching all of the pageantry.
I didn't get to watch any of it because, you know, Andrew is really not a monarchist.
I know.
His view is that if you pay for them, you feel differently. Which I can appreciate, but I do. It so brought to mind Victoria because I think Elizabeth, like Victoria, it's like, no, I mean, we all knew she was going to die, but you don't think it's ever going to happen, right?
Exactly.
I mean, I felt like that when I was writing and I got to 1901 and I was like, wait, Victoria's dead. How did that happen?
I know. I remember the book. You know, I feel the same way.
I feel like that with Elizabeth. I mean, you know, we knew she wasn't going to live forever. But at the same time, you're like, wait, what?
I must say, one thing, she passed away with such elegance. One day,
she did.
You know, it was, I don't
That's
know.
That's a good
so
way
you
to
did,
go,
yeah,
right?
You didn't get to see all the pageantry. I thought it was fantastic. I loved it. I was.
I have deep concerns, though, because did you see that Charles has already said that he wants to dial back the coronation?
I know, but I must say, I think one
that.
Of the best things about...
I am not here for mourning suits at a coronation. I want the peers in their robes.
Oh, I do.
I want them all putting their coronets on. No. Charles,
don't do it. I mean, that's one of the best things about England, actually, if you ask me.
Exactly.
And so I hope that, you know, when you are there, it is still so impressive. And to see it,
and
I think it's one of the best things about England, besides Fortnum and Mason. So, you know, of course, I mean, there's all, well, fish and chips, too, when you think about it. But that'll make Drew happy. I will say fish and chips, so he'll be happy.
Yeah. No, but nobody does pomp and circumstance better.
No, exactly. So I hope that you do get to see it, you know, some of the replay of it. Anyway, I want to thank you.
Oh, I will.
I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It is always a joy to talk to you. I hope that you'll come back again. You know, we have to have you back just not for a particular book, but just to talk in general about how you have created a series. This is number 16, I want to tell everybody. I mean, this is number 16, and it is a real sweet 16.
Oh, thank you.
You know, so when you get to that point, when you have, you know, Secrets of the Nile, Sweet 16, and everybody, it is available online. You can get it, and you should also go to Tasha's website. It's Tasha Alexander. That's easy enough. And I know that you are active on, I think you're more active on Instagram, huh?
I am. I had to abandon Twitter because it just
me too. I abandoned it.
Too depressing.
No.
Facebook is becoming the same way. So I'm like, I will post pictures.
Exactly.
On Instagram.
I think Instagram is really the thing to do. You do that very nicely. And again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. And I will have you back. That's what we'll do. We'll plan on a whole hour where we'll just talk how you create something so marvelous.
That would be very fun.
That will be great.
That would be so much fun.
Okay.
I would love that. And Patsy, it's just always such a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's a joy to talk to you.
I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, and say hi to Drew because he's going to be on at the end of the month. So you guys were really paralleling yourselves, each of you doing a book.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Well, send him my love, and I will be talking to him at the end of the month. Okay?
Sounds great.
Okay.
You take care.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Tasha Alexander.
Bye.
Her book is on sale today. It is released. It is exciting. Get it online, and you will have fun sailing up the Nile with Lady Emily, because Tasha Alexander is such a great writer. Bye-bye now, Tasha.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Okay. Wow. You know, I'm so grateful always to Tasha Alexander and, of course, her husband, Andrew Grant, or as I call him, Drew, and he even has another name. You know, this guy is multi-named because he is also Andrew Child, and he's going to be on October 27th. Bye-bye now.